Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome to the Tuesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. And today the introduction was correct. Jim Garrity is back. He's, of course, from National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Jim was on Easter break last week. I really think he was secretly scouting out the special election in South Carolina's first congressional district, but he could have done both, I guess. But Jim, any insights on that?
I couldn't get away from politics on my vacation. It was not, you know, of all, there are three going on. Three of the 435 districts have elections going on. I had to go to one of the three that had it going on. So
based on the polling I saw, it looks like Mark Sanford versus Stephen Colbert's sister. Is that the likely scenario after today's primary, or does Bostick have a chance down there?
It is. Bostick has a chance. I mean, he's the thing is that Bostick has a strong base, but the question is, it's not big enough. You know, that basically there's a passionate group of evangelical conservatives and homeschoolers who like him a lot. No doubt Mark Sanford has his ceiling, but at this point that ceiling, at least according to the polling, was a little higher. And, you know, for a lot of conservatives that they're, you know, upset about the infamous scandal back in 2009, but they, you know, they've gotten past it. They remember him as a good tax-cutting, budget-cutting governor, and obviously that's the preeminent issue right now. The Democrats salivating over Sanford versus a woman, but it's kind of interesting. I continue to argue that if Stephen Colbert were not a famous comedian, no one would be arguing that Elizabeth Colbert Bush should be running for House. So he's got a whole bunch of other siblings, so maybe the DCCC would run them in other races.
Exactly.
Anyway, that's my cynicism talking. Let's get started on martinis.
Yeah, right? That's not actually one of the martinis. The good martini today.
Bonus martini.
Yes, bonus martini. Good news from Arkansas and Virginia. They are moving forward and have now enacted laws to enforce photo voter ID at the polls. Virginia starting in 2014, I believe. Arkansas doing the same. You got your opponents of this calling it a backdoor poll tax, you know, because poor people can't afford this. Virginia's Governor Bob McDonnell saying, well, if you can't afford one, we'll give it to you for free. So there goes your poll tax argument. And once again, we can verify that the people who are voting are who they say they are. And so, Jim, this is something we would obviously like to see coast to coast. We'll see if the Justice Department gets involved, since these are two states that I believe are under the Voting Rights Act. But it's only common sense, and especially now that Virginia is a swing state, this could be a really big deal.
It could be. My impression, interaction with voting here in Virginia in the, you know, probably about 6 years that I've been doing it, is that they seem pretty good and diligent about checking your name on the rolls and things like that. However, obviously, every little bit helps, and you don't want anybody absentee ballot voting generally seem like the more troublesome way. I mean, you know, vote by mail and stuff like that. The poll tax arguing folks have one smidgen of a point here, which is that it should not cost you money to exercise one of your basic constitutional rights, which is to say the right to vote. And so I'm glad to see the state is saying, look, you should have a photo ID. You should have some way to verify you are who you say you are. But it should not cost you an arm and a leg. And, you know, all that the state is asking is do a little preparation before you go to vote. Make sure you're registered to vote. This is, you know, that's never been considered a particularly high burden to put upon potential voters. So the fact that so many folks on the left fight this so vehemently and insistently and screaming racism at the first opportunity really makes you wonder how dependent they are upon potential voting fraud and things of that nature. Just good to see this is passing in two states. And again, this should not be an impossible hurdle to get people to verify you are who you say you are, because otherwise anybody who commits voter fraud gets to have two votes or more votes, and you and I only get one. It devalues the vote for everyone else. So the fact that this passed in a key swing state is generally a good sign. If they can make it work in Virginia, they really should be able to make it work in just about any other state.
On to martini number two now, and this is still about the analysis of the 2012 election frustrations on the right. Former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee, 2008 presidential candidate, saying essentially that nominating two moderates, the GOP doing that in 2008 and 2012 with John McCain and Mitt Romney, essentially turning off evangelical voters, saying a lot of them went to the polls reluctantly or just didn't go at all. Interestingly, though, if you look at the exit polls, and the folks at Hot Air did that, Ala Pundit in particular, shows that Mitt Romney got exactly the same percentage of born-again evangelicals that George W. Bush got in 2004 and did considerably better than McCain did. And if you look at Protestants and Christians across the board, Romney actually did a little bit better than George W. Bush. So the finger-pointing on evangelicals, certainly in this case, doesn't seem to be true. Although I think Huckabee, in another point, and this is probably getting off the rabbit trail a little bit, that if the party doesn't at least stand behind marriage, that could be a problem for evangelicals in the future. But in terms of what happened in 2012, I think the search for an answer still goes on.
Yeah, it's a conflation of two points. The first being that whether the gay marriage issue is the preeminent issue amongst evangelical voters. And then the second argument is, we've seen a lot of this since November, this whole argument of, well, the reason the party lost is it didn't do enough to appeal to people like me. Depending on who you are, that may be very accurate or it may be very not accurate. I'm among those who is rather skeptical of the idea that there's this deep, you know, trove of voters out there who were just waiting for a chance to vote for somebody. But, if, you know, in the case of the Huckabee argument is that, well, they just weren't convinced that Mitt Romney would be better for their social conservative views than Barack Obama was. If you really believe that there wasn't enough of a difference between Mitt Romney and Barack Obama, I really don't know what to say to you. Even if, you know, somebody wasn't perfect on all of your issues, there was a huge difference on economic issues, on social issues, how they regarded Obamacare mandates, birth control mandates, one after another. And so it's one of the other great observations in this point over on hotair.com was that Romney actually did slightly better amongst evangelicals than he did with Mormons,
right,
which is not what you'd expect from a Mormon candidate. When you add all that up, I really can't have a very hard time believing that, well, if we'd just gotten the evangelical vote out more, 2012 would have been a different result. I just don't think you can see that in the numbers. And so you add this up and you come to a conclusion that there's kind of this egocentric interpretation of the 2012 results. And if we want Republicans to get back to winning national presidential elections again, we need to look at these things kind of honestly and clear-eyed. And it can't just be that, well, we didn't do enough of what I like, and if we do more of what I like, we will win national elections. I kind of have this argument with a whole bunch of folks on conservatives. Sadly, we are not the average voter. If we were, we'd be winning all the time. Well, the answer is that we are unique. We are genetic freaks, you could say, with an unhealthy level of interest in politics and informed about the issues and such. So we come up with ideas and policies and proposals and slogans and all these things that are really fantastic for appealing to us. But in the end, Mitt Romney and John McCain and George W. Bush and just about every Republican candidate has pretty much starts with us in the bank. I mean, Greg, I think you and I would agree. They'd have to – Republicans would have to nominate maybe Alvin Green level bad candidate before we would even consider voting for the Democrat. We're just folks on the right. So we're already in there. Obviously, you want to nominate the best candidate you can, but – don't fool yourself into thinking that your ideal candidate is necessarily going to sweep to a, you know, Reagan versus Mondale level victory. Huckabee is engaging in a bit of wishful thinking here, basically telling people what they want to hear, that all they need is a candidate who appeals to them more. Well, these folks are already turning out and voting. The real issue in 2012 is that there are large swaths of the electorate who don't see any appeal in the Republican Party. And, you know, between now and 2016, that has to change.
I did vote for all those people that you mentioned. I still think my vote for John McCain might be the least enthusiastic presidential vote I've ever cast. And I voted for Bob Dole. So just to put it out there.
That's a lack of enthusiasm right there.
All right, on to the crazy now, and, you know, about all the different sequestration tools the White House is inflicting upon the American people, canceling the tours and shutting down air traffic control centers, threatening to cancel the Easter egg roll, which unfortunately did go off yesterday, and the president put on a fabulous display of missing basketball shots. But the White House also announcing on Monday that 480 staffers who work at the Office of Management and Budget have received furlough notices requiring that they take unpaid days off due to the sequester. Jay Carney making the announcement saying that even folks who work pretty close to the president could be impacted by this. And Jim, a couple things here. That seems like a lot of people to be working on a budget. And secondly, if you got that many people working on the budget, why is it 2 months late?
Yeah, also, you'd figure it'd be more balanced, wouldn't you?
Right.
I mean, like 480 people. Somebody, at least one would say, you know, Mr. President, this is really out of balance. You know, with the first year's budget, you know, $1.6 trillion debt, then it's down to $1.1 trillion around the next 2 years. $1.3 or $4, I believe it was. It was down to $1.1 trillion, and they might get it under $1 trillion this year, Greg. We're supposed to be dancing a jig over this. You look at this, I'm glad, you know, one, you kind of marvel at just how large the Office of Management and Budget is. And two, I guess it's good news that sequester is finally hitting into White House operations and stuff. I'm still kind of struck by whether the president's personal chef is considered a critical employee during sequester and during times of belt tightening and things like this. In light of that, you kind of look at a lot of these federal agencies where they're having to squeeze a little bit here, squeeze a little bit there. Do you think the folks, like, they'll just be able to get more done in those 4 days a week? Look, hopefully with these 480 people not in the office, I'd hate to see us run up terrible debt in the absence of these budget managers. Wouldn't you, Greg? I mean, that'd be absolutely the worst case scenario.
Yeah, I can't imagine that. Jeez. Unbelievable. Yeah, you'd think you could do that probably with 48 staffers if you really tried. Jim, have a great day. Welcome back. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Looking forward to tomorrow, Greg. See you tomorrow.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And be sure to join us again on Wednesday for the next edition of the 3 Martini Lunch.